Amen. All right, Matthew chapter 24. We stopped in verse 20-ish. But basically, to recap, at the end of chapter 23, Jesus predicts the downfall, the destruction of the temple, when he says, "Look, your house has left you desolate." He then, in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 24, says, "Hey, temple's going down." The disciples ask a question, but they conflate two primary, different, or two distinct events. They conflate the destruction of the temple and what other event? The second coming, the consummation of the age. They think they're the same. Jesus then goes through to show them that they are distinct. They are distinct in two ways. Number one, the destruction of the temple has a bunch of signs where the second coming doesn't. Number two, there's a significant delay between each of them. One of them is described in imminent language. One of them will be described in long distance language. So that's kind of the distinction he's laying out for them. However, they both accomplish... They both have in the similarities the fact that they each usher in a new creation. They each are attached to some sort of new creation concept. So we started going through the first 20 verses and we started asking the question, does this line up with the destruction of the temple? And what we're finding is it in fact does. Now we've reached the abomination of desolation. Basically what we've learned so far, and what is it, verses 17 through 20, I think. Whoa, I'm in chapter 25. That was messing with my head. I was like, talents? Okay. Yeah. Around that area. 17 through 20. Is that when abomination of desolation comes, you get out of Dodge and you get out of Dodge quick. You leave. You drop everything and go. And he says, pray that it doesn't happen on different days or different things, that your flight doesn't have to happen in areas or in situations that would cause you to be slow. Like pregnant women, or winter, or the Sabbath. Why would the Sabbaths impede the flight of the Christians? Yeah, because buddy, if you're somebody running on the Sabbath, that's a lot of work on a day that Jews don't do much work. And when you're in Jerusalem, it's going to be very clear who is and who isn't out of the camp. So, let's ask the question, what is the abomination of desolation? Abomination of desolation is something that is connected to the temple, but I do not believe it is the destruction of the temple itself. Some people will try to suggest that the abomination of desolation is the destruction of the temple, but initially, why is that awkward? Think contextually. Why would that be an awkward interpretation of the abomination of desolation, practically speaking? What is the message of the abomination of desolation to the Christians? Whenever you see the abomination of desolation, he says to the Christians, get out of Dodge. But guess what? If the temple's being destroyed, that means they've wiped out pretty much the whole city. Not time to get out then. Right? As a matter of fact, what happens in AD 70? They wipe out pretty much everyone around. They're not messing around. As a matter of fact, Josephus describes that there's over 10,000 people that were killed in the temple alone. It's massacre. So if the abomination, desolation, and destruction of the temple, you might say, okay, well, could we have a little bit more of a warning than that? Before they're already destroying everything, do you mind giving us a warning and then letting us go? Some Christians interpret another event as the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel. What is the event they usually point to besides the destruction of the temple context? It's earlier. Antiochus Epiphanes, exactly. Where they take the sacrifice of a pig and they make it sacrificed on the altar. And they would say, that is one of the fulfillments of the abomination of desolation. But Jesus takes that same concept and he says, there's another one a-coming. And it's similar. It is the sacrilege that makes the city unholy. Be it through what we're going to see in a minute, possibly war, but I think another situation. Remember two classes ago, we were talking about the graven images inside of the temple. What did I say was one of the things that they really were fighting against, not just inside the temple, but where else were graven images not allowed? In the city itself. Keep that in mind. Because under Pontius Pilate, whenever Pontius Pilate snuck in the different Roman insignias, the Jews were willing to have themselves killed for it to be taken out of the city. Why? Because it was that big of a deal. That big of a desecration. Okay, here we go. Luke chapter 21, verse 20. Flip there, because it gives us a major clue as to what this abomination of desolation could be. Again, if you're a futurist, you do not want to parallel chapter 21 of Luke with Matthew 24. It just blows everything out of the water. Chapter 21, verse 20. When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation, same word, is near. What does he equate the abomination, a key symbol of the abomination of desolation? The army's impingement on the city. Okay? All right, let me read to you something by a guy named William Shea. William Shea is a professor, or at least he used to be, at Andrews University Seminary. He wrote this in spring 2002, and he's describing events Josephus is describing, but he is the first one I've ever seen attach this to the explanation of Matthew chapter 24, verse 20, abomination of desolation, and I like it. Listen to what he describes. This is happening in AD 66, 4 years before the temple is destroyed. He says, after finally turning back the attack of the Jews upon his troops at Gibeon at the beginning of the Festival of Tabernacles, Cestius Gallus, so a Roman general, moved his troops on to attack the city of Jerusalem at its northeastern corner. He broke through the outer wall at that point and fought all the way up to the retaining wall of the temple area. When is this happening? 4 years before the temple is destroyed. His troops were making efforts to break through the wall, and they prepared to burn the gate on that side of the temple area. The defenders of the city were very discouraged as they retreated into the temple and palace area, thinking this would be the site of their last stand. What date are we? AD 66. How many years before their last stand? 4. Then, with victory in grasp, Cestius suddenly decided to call off the attack, much to the surprise of the defenders. Of this moment, Josephus observed that had he at that particular moment decided to force his way through the walls, he would have captured the city forthwith and the war would have been over. When would the war have been over if Cestius Gallus had kept moving? AD 66. When was it really over? AD 70, last group killed in 73. By turning back, the opportunity for victory passed from the Romans. They had to fight their way in retreat to Caesarea to the coast. So instead of taking the city, ending the war, they retreat and actually have to fight their way back to Caesarea. With the final defeat of the rear guard force occurring in the Beth Horon Pass. Here are some interesting facts about this event. Josephus tells us that this occurred on the eighth day of Dias, which would have in AD 66, which would have been October 16th, 1860 or AD 66. AD 66, not 18. AD 66. Here's what's significant for me in that. Number one, it's 4 to 6 weeks away before winter comes. Number one. Number two, the day that Cestius Gallus was there and the flight was going to have to occur was the Sabbath. Interesting. Because if the Christians would have had to have fleed in that moment, they would have been done. But instead, he inexplicably retreats, goes back to Caesarea, and then we have an opportunity for Christians to leave. As a matter of fact, Shea says this, I'll read this because this is good. It says, this interlude provided Christians and Jews time to flee as Jesus had instructed them. Moreover, the Roman legions and banners were brought up to the wall of the temple enclosure in this initial phase of the war. Ooh, did you hear that? What was brought up to the temple wall? Banners. What was on the banners? Graven images. An abomination, according to some people. The signal was given that it was time to flee, and the Roman retreat provided the opportunity to do so. Here's the question. Did the Christians retreat then? Historically, that's the question I would need to ask. If this is the abomination of desolation, the signal that the army breaks through the wall, they come up and have graven images surrounding the temple, and then they inexplicably retreat as they were beginning to light the fire to burn down the wall. Did Christians flee at this point? Yes. Josephus writes, after the catastrophe of Cestius, many distinguished Jews abandoned the city as swimmers desert a sinking ship. Eusebius says that it was around this point that Christians began to flee to Pella. The Christians, in other words, this is my theory. The Christians were looking for the abomination of desolation. They saw it and got out of Dodge. And they were so thankful that they didn't have to flee on the Sabbath, but they had enough time to flee in the coming days right before winter, so they had enough time to get to a safe place before all hell broke loose in Jerusalem. Interesting to me. Okay, verse 21. For then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. We already talked about, some people will say, the greatest distress ever? How can you possibly say that and not be at the end of everything? Listen, first of all, distress is very relative in how you gauge it, number one. Number two, I do have some interesting things from church fathers. We did read that one story yesterday, right? With the woman eating her child. Yeah. It was a little bad. Chrysostom, he writes this. He says, do not let anyone suppose that he is merely speaking in hyperbole, talking about Jesus in this text here. All you need to do is study the writings of Josephus, Chrysostom tells us, to learn the truth of these predictions. No one who knows the fact of history can say that Christian believers have exaggerated this tragic history or been any part of trying to see that Christ's words were fulfilled. What does Josephus say about this situation in AD 66 through 70? He says, I shall therefore speak my mind here at once briefly, that neither did any other city ever suffer such miseries, nor did any age ever breed a generation more fruitful in wickedness than this was from the beginning of the world. It's interesting that Josephus' language is pretty similar to Jesus, even though Josephus wouldn't have claimed to follow Jesus at all. Because what was Josephus? He was a Jew that's turned Benedict Arnold. He's hanging out with the Romans now. All right. Moving on. Verse 23. At that time, at what time? At the destruction of the temple? At the abomination of desolation. Whenever you're getting out of Dodge, after the signal has been gone up and it's time for you to get out. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. We've already gone over this last class, where there were multiple. Matter of fact, Jerome says there were many Jews claiming to be the Christ during this time. And at the time of the besieging of Jerusalem, there were three distinct groups within the city itself. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. I love that. See, I have told you ahead of time. You see his emphasis here? What has he told them ahead of time? What has he told them? Nothing? What has he told them ahead of time? The signs of the destruction of the temple. He's told them ahead of time everything to look for. That when the abomination of desolation is coming up, what that's going to look like. He's told them ahead of time. You shouldn't be shocked when these things start to happen. The signs will be very clear. I've told you ahead of time. Why? So that you will not be deceived. That's how he starts off this whole thing in verse 4. So he starts off in verse 4. Watch out that no one deceives you. Who is you? Who is you? Disciples. The disciples. So, verse 26, if anyone tells you there he is out in the desert, do not go out. Or here he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. Now here's the question. We cannot take the next verses out of context. It's so easy to. Because everything that we've been taught in our lives tells us to. But you have to keep it in context. Notice the flow. He's recapping everything he's pretty much said so far. And then he comes and he says this. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. What is he talking about there? A lot of times what people try to do with this verse is they say, bam, second coming. Really? Is that what he's been talking about so far? It doesn't seem that way. But all of a sudden now, we're going to immediately take this passage because it's something we've been told. When Jesus comes, it'll be as clear as lightning is from the east to the west. As a matter of fact, I was teaching on this particular passage in a church. And the irony was whenever I walked out by their bathrooms, they had a sign that was up there promoting the second coming of Jesus, and it had this passage. And the irony of it was, is people said, is our sign wrong in the hallway? I said, yeah, in context it is. Because in context, the lightning coming from the east and the west is not talking about Jesus' second coming. It's talking about the coming of Him at the destruction of Jerusalem, right? How do you define the word coming? In the Old Testament, there's all kinds of comings of God, aren't there? And whenever God comes in the Old Testament, is it the very last coming, or is it coming on a nation as in judgment? What is it? How do you know? Context. The coming of the Son of Man, so far, which we will find more defined clearly later, could be one or the other, and yet He's going to be very clear on what it is. It's the coming on the Jerusalem destruction. Because, like lightning is from the east to the west, it's going to be very clear. The signs will be evident. You will not, if you're missing it, then you're just not paying attention. Wherever, now this is what I really want us to focus on, because I think He is once again summarizing what happens at the destruction of the temple in verse 28. Wherever there is a carcass, there vultures will gather. I will say this really quick, let me back up. Lightning is something that is a common feature of God's judgments in the Old Testament. It's all over the place. Matter of fact, it's even used in Revelation. It's used in Revelation 1, 2, 3, 4 times. Lightning, peals of thunder, rumblings and earthquakes. Thunder's judgment language. That comes at the Revelation chapter 4, verse, I believe, 6, at the foot of the throne. Then it happens in 8, at the end of the seals. It happens at the end of the trumpets in 11. And it happens at the end of the bowls in 16. Lightning. Judgment language. So, judgment. Okay. Wherever there is a carcass, there vultures gather. Okay, we need to define some words here. Matter of fact, 3 key words. Because the NIV botches this up to no end. It actually is astounding. First of all, the word for carcass is really better translated corpse. The word for the reason why they translate it carcass is because they're influenced by their translation of the word for vulture. But we'll get to that in a minute. It's really the word potoma for corpse. As a matter of fact, Josephus used this word all the time to describe the corpses of battle. Battle corpses. The Septuagint actually uses it 14 out of its 21 times to refer to God's judgment on the wicked, usually in connection to Israel. So you're starting to see that this is a battle corpse. Corpses laying around as if battle has occurred. Here comes the second word, and this is where everything turns on a dime. The word for vulture boggles my mind. Because nowhere in the history of antiquity is Itoi ever translated vulture, except for here. Ever. I don't get it. Usually what they do is they take this word, and we'll talk about what Itoi is in a minute, and they say vulture because they're trying to communicate a second coming concept, where the second coming would be so clear, it's as clear as a vulture that's going around its carcass. But guess what the word really should be translated as? Eagle. If that's not Roman, I don't know what is. America didn't have that symbol of their nation first. Who did? Rome. As a matter of fact, that's probably what would have been on the images of the standards that were surrounding the temple in Cestius Gallus' charge in Jerusalem in AD 66. The eagle surrounding the corpses. As a matter of fact, let me say this a couple of things. Number one, though, if you wanted to say vulture, you could say the word Greek word goops. That's vulture, but that's not the word here. It's itoi. There is no reference to eating at all in Matthew 24. You think there's eating because of the words they've used, the vulture surrounding the carcass. But there's no concept of eating here. Number three, eagles don't eat carrion anyway. They eat live prey. So if I'm using the word itoi, it can't be a carcass. It's probably a corpse. There's not even mention of a bird circling the corpse. And that brings me to my third key word. The word for gathered together. Gathered together is sunakthesantai. Gathered together. It does not mean circling. It does not mean hovering. It does not mean feeding. The word gathered together a lot of times is used for groups that share a common experience or fate. Okay, you piecing this together yet? What he's picturing here is this. The corpse, the battle corpses of all the Jews in Jerusalem at the destruction of the temple, that are gathered together with Rome, who has been sent by God to destroy them. But those two will share the same fate because they are gathered together. You see what he's doing? He's describing everything he's already described. He's just using it in a picture form. And he's saying, this will be as visible as lightning is from the east and the west. What you have to do here is fight your second coming tendencies and actually read the text for what it's saying. But man, we can tweak things just enough to make us feel really comfortable. All right. So, immediately after the stress of those days, now we're going to be moving into another section that people think is second coming. But the word immediately should give us pause. Yeah? Because what's weird about it is this. In chapter 24 and 25, Jesus is going to be saying, after a long delay, after a long delay, after a long delay. So if he says, after the destruction of the temple, immediately, I'm going to come back, all of a sudden you're going, well, which is right, Jesus? Are you contradicting yourself? And frankly, let's act like he was. Why would Matthew put that in his gospel? Does he really want his Lord to look like a fool? No. There's probably a better answer than Jesus contradicting himself. It's probably that he's saying something that we refuse to acknowledge. Also, the word thlipsis, which is the word for distress there, in Matthew it is always used, or in context, it's always been used to describe the events leading up to the destruction of the temple. So immediately after the distress of those days, the events, immediately after the distress, the difficulties leading up to the destruction of the temple, what's going to immediately happen after the difficulties? The destruction of the temple. So immediately after the events leading up to the destruction of the temple, that's how you should read that. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. What does that sound like? What did you say? Somebody say Revelation? Yeah, he does use that in Revelation. Where else do we find it? We find it several places in the Bible.
Jesus dies.
Kind of, yeah, Jesus dies. There is a darkening of the sun. Well, let's just take that for a second. Well, no, let's not take that for a second. Let's keep adding on to this because I want to make sure I get through some of my stuff today. In Acts chapter 2, Peter says, in the last days, he's trying to describe what's just happened to them. The men will be prophesying, and so will their sons and daughters. They'll be seeing visions and all kinds of dreams. And he says, and the moon will be blood red, and the sun will be darkened. And he guess what is he saying in that whole section? He's saying that, what Joel's talking about there, is this. Pentecost. Because whenever you're talking about heavenly bodies being affected, you're always talking about political upheaval. Always. A new kingdom is established when another one leaves. Therefore, a lot of times what you will see is you'll see this language of the sun being darkened, the moon turning to blood red, and all the stars in the sky being blotted out. Whenever you're talking about judgment of a political nation. As a matter of fact, Isaiah chapter 13, 9 through 10, almost the exact same language is used to describe the destruction of Babylon at the hand of God. Interesting. Ezekiel chapter 32, verse 2 and verse 7, uses almost the exact same language of the sun being blackened, the moon turning to blood red, and the stars being blotted out to describe the destruction of Pharaoh at the hand of God. That is not second coming language. It is new creation language. But whenever a kingdom is destroyed and a new one comes to power, that is just like all of creation being created anew. Same concepts. So whenever you see this language, you think political upheaval. Why did he bring it into play? Whoa. Why did he bring it into play in Acts chapter 2? Because their kingdom was being established. It's political upheaval. It's something so significant that all of the heavens will be affected. Everything. And this is one of the reasons why also that Rome, in a lot of their myths and even in their temples, are connected to the heavenly realm, the heavenly beings, the heavenly things. Matter of fact, near the Circus Maximus in Rome, there's a temple dedicated to the sun and the moon. Why? Because the gods are the ones that control the heavenly bodies. Gods are the ones that control the governments and power. And whenever they make the heavenly bodies move, so also do they make the governmental powers on the earth move. So if Jesus says the sun will be darkened, the moon will be turned to blood red, and the stars will be blotted out, he's saying God's moving the political reality of earth. Is this making sense? We're still in the context of the temple, because that is a major political upheaval. At that time, at what time? At the destruction of the temple. The sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. What does that refer to? What? Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. How do I know that? It's not just because of this. It's not just because of Son of Man language, but it's Son of Man language coupled with what? Clouds. Coming on the clouds. Coming on the clouds. There is nowhere in the entire Old Testament where the language of Son of Man coming on the clouds appears except for Daniel chapter 7. And what is the context of Daniel chapter 7? The establishing of the kingdom of God at the first coming. Because where is he coming to? To heaven from earth. Don't think chronology, think event. What is that describing? The establishment of the kingdom. Here's the reality. Jesus' cross, Jesus' resurrection, Jesus' ascension, that's a cloud, and the destruction of the temple are all parts of vindicating or validating his ministry. All of it. Here's a manger. And we'll even do this. Fire. All of this is the establishing of the kingdom. When is the kingdom established? Jesus says in Matthew chapter 13, it's not established at a moment. It's establishing. And these are the key events that is happening that says, my kingdom is here. So when is it established? Is it established here? Or is it established only here? Or is it established here? Or is it established here? When? Yes! This is what the establishment of the kingdom looks like. It's all of this. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one of the end of the heaven to the other. I don't think that the word for angels, angelos, should be translated angels there. I think it should be translated messengers. Why would I say that?
Number four refers to the earth. And so, more likely it'd be his messengers here on earth.
Yeah. And who's he talking to? Disciples. Who are what? His messengers. And they're the ones that are going to be going to spread to the ends of the earth to gather his elect. To gather them together. And you know why he adds the whole loud trumpet call? Not because it's second coming language, because that's battle language. Trumpets in the Old Testament are one of the primary elements of war. Primary elements of war. What is he saying in all this? When the temple's destroyed, my people will spread and they will gather those that belong to me. All right. Whew, that's crazy. Okay, verse 32. Let's summarize everything. Verse 32, Jesus says, we need to stop and take a breath and summarize. He says, now, learn this lesson from the fig tree. Whoa, where have we heard fig tree? Matthew chapter 21. In that context, what was it referring to? Judgment on Israel. Yeah? Because the fig tree is something that is related to the passages and the prophets and things of that nature, describing the faithfulness or unfaithfulness of Israel, whether they are fruitful or not. All right. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is right, that is near, right at the door. Okay, so what he's saying is this. Let's look at the fig tree. Whenever you see that its leaves are starting to come out, what do you know is inevitably here? Summer. And they would say, yeah, because you know what? They're not idiots. They understand the earth better than we do because that's all they have to live on. They get it. I'm not saying that we are idiots. I'm saying in this context, they would have gotten it. When fig trees begin to bud, summer's coming. It's a very clear sign. It's very convenient that the fig tree also has the metaphorical parallel to the judgment of Israel from just five chapters earlier. But why would that be significant that he would come back to the fig tree? Because this entire context, the first 33, 34 verses, has been focusing on the destruction, the judgment of Israel. You see? So he says, just like the fig tree, when it starts to bud for summer, so too, when you start to see these signs, it is very clear what's coming. The destruction of the temple is here. You will see it. It is evident. You won't miss it. And then he says this, I tell you the truth. This generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. How do we define this generation? How do you define that? Some people, well, there's three options. Some people will say it's a future generation. It's the generation right before the second coming. But right before that, we're going to push it off. This is what people like this guy will do. They'll just push it off into the future. That's the generation he's talking about. But that's interesting because, man, you can just pretty much, if I can just take the word you, make it say whatever I want. If I can take the word this, make it say whatever I want. Shoot, if I can take the word generation, make that say whatever I want, then I can make the Bible say whatever I want at any point. I can do whatever I want. Language at that point becomes absolutely moot. It doesn't matter what language says. I can make it say what I want. So when he says this generation, I really only have one way to define this. Yeah? The contemporaries of Jesus. So here's the question. Was he wrong? Did Jesus think he was predicting the second coming and that this generation would experience it and he was just wrong? That's a possibility. And yet, if you read it in context, it doesn't have to be the most likely scenario. What's the most likely scenario is Jesus says, this generation will see the destruction of the temple. And guess what? It's just like the fig tree. Whenever it starts to bud, you know summer's near. When this event starts to happen, you know that this event's about to occur. You're not going to be fooled. Don't let anybody deceive you. It'll be very clear. This generation, well, matter of fact, I have actually a pretty funny quote. It's not that funny. All right, I'll read it to you. It's by D.A. Carson. He just says, a word which can only with the greatest... He's talking about this generation. A word which can only with the greatest difficulty be made to mean anything other than the generation living than Jesus, when Jesus spoke. See, wasn't that funny? Okay. This is the one I wanted to get to, though, because verse 35, I think, sums up everything we've just talked about. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. People will say, see, Shane? Second coming. I agree that that is new creation talk. But here's the question. Isn't the destruction of the temple also a new creation moment? And let me get a little Jewish on you for a minute. The temple is described in many different places, describing the organization of the cosmos within it. As a matter of fact, in Jubilees 8:19, 1 Enoch 26:1, it's called the navel of the earth. It's commonly linked even and described as a microcosm of the entire cosmos. This is what you find in the temple scroll in Qumran, 11QT29:9, if anybody cares. They describe it as a microcosm of the cosmos. As a matter of fact, in different Mishnah and things of that nature, they describe even the way in which the architecture, the way in which it was made, was meant to reflect the way in which the entire earth was made. The outer courts being the sea, and the more you get closer, being the heavens in itself and the Holy of Holies. It's created like the microcosm of the heavens and the earth. That's the point. That's the reason why Herod was lambasted whenever he was trying to make remake the temple, and he wanted to reorient the way it was structured. And the Jews went crazy because you can't reorient it because it is a microcosm of the cosmos. In other words, the way in which it's described in the Babylonian Talmud, Barakat 55a, is It says this, Bezalel knew the letters by which heaven and earth were created. And guess what he's talking about there? The temple. He actually refers to the temple as what? Heaven and earth. Why? It's a microcosm of creation. It is heaven and earth because the Holy of Holies is the heavens. And everything moving out from that is the earth. And this is their myth, not in the sense of false, but myth in the sense of explaining the way things are. This is their myth of their theology. That God is in the heavens and He has created the earth. And that's why the temple itself, the place where we worship this one, is structured off of His entire creation. It's a microcosm of everything. Therefore, it is referred to at times as heaven and earth. Therefore, when Jesus says, heaven and earth will pass away, I think He's saying for the third time, the temple is going to be destroyed. I think it's an inclusio. He begins this conversation with saying the temple is going to be destroyed, and now He's ending it with saying heaven and earth will pass away. The temple will be destroyed. Why? Because in the minds of the Jews, the temple was heaven and earth, which is why the question came about to begin with. If the temple leaves, that means all of heaven and earth is gone, right? Yes and no. Heaven and earth, the temple will be gone, but heaven and earth will still be going. All right. Now comes the major, major shift. How do I know it's a major shift? Because of the words the NIV delete at the very beginning of chapter 24, verse 36. All it says here is no one knows. But in the Greek, how does it start off? But concerning, peri day. Why is that? Why are those two words so important? Has anybody taken 1 Corinthians? It is everywhere in 1 Corinthians. How is Paul using it in 1 Corinthians?
To change what he's talking
about. Shifting topics. He's saying, let's talk about this, da-da-da-da-da. But concerning peri day, this, da-da-da-da-da. But concerning this, peri day. But concerning, it is a strong break. A strong break in topic. Peri day, but concerning, break in topic. What would he be breaking from? What topic is he coming from and what is he shifting to? He comes from the destruction of the temple and he says, but concerning what? Second coming. You've conflated these two events. Let me separate them. But concerning the second coming, no one knows about the day or hour. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. He's being a good rabbi here. He's saying, how much more? If the angels who have access to God don't know, if the Son who has access to God doesn't know, then how much more do you not know when you don't even have access to Him? You see what he's doing? That's where I always bring this up. Wonderful little book. No, I did not pay money for this. It's really fascinating, though, to me that they actually have a map of the way in which it's going to end. Man, I wish Jesus had that, then this whole verse would be different. Because no one knows except for the Father, only the Son, or except for if you buy Charting the End Times. Then you know. That's very convenient. We're going to talk a little rapture here. Ooh, right before, don't worry about it, right before the holidays. We have 3 minutes. We're going to talk about the whole rapture right here, okay? Here is one of the key reasons. This is one of the key passages for rapture coming up here. And this is one of the key reasons why I reject it vehemently. Okay? Here we go. Number one, well, let me say this really quick. If you're a historian and you really care, the first time the rapture was ever uttered in the history of the world was 1830 by a woman by the name of Margaret MacDonald. I have her letter, the first time it was ever written, in my office in the back of a book. So it's not like I'm making this up. She went into a self-induced trance, or a self-induced fever, so she can move herself into a prophetic trance. And a man was there by the name of John Nelson Darby, who ended up putting the theological muscle behind the rapture, came over to America 6 different times bringing this teaching, established a group known as the Plymouth Brethren, which eventually began to influence people like Cyrus Scofield, who had the Scofield Reference Bible. Scofield Reference Bible was the very first study Bible in the history of modern history. But the problem was that he was perpetuating all this dispensational stuff at the bottom, and people were not understanding what was inspired at top and what was not inspired at the bottom. As that began to develop, it also influenced a guy by the name of Dwight L. Moody, who established the Moody Bible Institute, of which someone by the name of Billy Graham graduated from and wrote the book Approaching Hoofbeats. He's recanted, by the way, in recent years. But he was a major influence on a guy by the name of Hal Lindsey, who wrote the book Late Great Planet Apes. in the 1970s, which outsold in that decade the Bible. And that was a major influence for a guy by the name of Tim LaHaye, who wrote The Left Behind series, along with a guy named Jerry Jenkins, that sold well over 65 million worldwide. And that's how a brand new teaching, a brand new doctrine in the history of the world, only 180 years old, can become the dominant theology. Modern day. Here's their primary passage. One of. There are three. One of them is ridiculous. The other one's a little more convoluted. This is one of the big ones. Let me read for you verses 40 and 41 first. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill. One will be taken, the other left. Have you heard that in connection to the rapture? Yeah. Now let's read it in context. Always a good thing. Start in verse 37. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the coming of the Son of Man. What's he saying? Let's look at Noah, a new creation story, by the way. Let's look at Noah, and this will be the same way it'll be at the second coming. Awesome. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they, who is they there? They knew nothing about what would happen. Who's they? The people outside of the ark. The evil ones, right? The evil people. What would happen? Until the flood came and took them all away. Who was taken away? Who did the flood come and take away? The evil people. Because Noah and his family still stayed on the earth, yeah? That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Here's my question. Who's taken? If I'm going off of Noah, it's the evil that are taken. And the good are left behind. What? Here's the thing that's so beautifully ironic for me with the rapture. Is that they get the wrong people leaving. They miss the key point of their whole thing. Because in the days of Noah, who was taken away from the earth? Not the good, the evil were. And this shouldn't surprise us because Matthew 13 told us this, right? That at the harvest of the age, into the age, whenever the angels come, who is taken first? Yes, the weeds are pulled up. Then the wheat are gathered and they're put into the barn houses. Right? This is why I reject the rapture. Number one, very convenient for comfortable Americans to say, hey, when everything is about ready to get really bad, we're out of here. Awesome. That's convenient. How nice. Second thing I rejected is it's pretty early, or it's pretty late in the game, because for 1800 years no one ever talked about this. You'd think it'd be a topic of conversation at some point. Third reason is because one of their key texts, they blow. They don't even get it. They have the good people being taken away when it's actually the evil in context. But hey, who cares about context? If we ignore context, we can make the Bible say whatever we want. Yeah? Yes?
Rapture is completely made up.
Oh yeah. Rapture is absolutely false. Absolutely false.
Like the second coming of Jesus.
No. The rapture and the second coming of Jesus are two totally different things.
Right. Okay.
I believe that when Jesus comes, it's over. Everything's over. I believe that he could come before we finish this class and it's over. We don't have to have the rapture of the church, 7 years of tribulation, 1,000 years reigning on earth. It's over. When he comes, nothing else happens but eternity. It's it. That's why Acts chapter 2 calls this time period the last days. Acts chapter 2, Hebrews chapter 1 says, in these last days he has spoken to us through his Son. What last days? These. How are we living in the last days? We have been for 2,000 years. According to the Bible. Because it is used 7 times in the Bible, last times and last days, and every single time it's referring to the first coming, second coming of Christ. What I'm saying is that the whole concept of the rapture, the whole concept of 7 years of tribulation, it is something that has come about in the last 180 years. And even the text that they use to claim, two will be walking to the field, one taken to the other left. Rapture of whom? The evil. Why? Because we're still going to use this place. It's going to be purified with fire. We're going to come back down with our Lord, and heaven and earth will become one. Read Revelation chapter 21, where heaven and earth, the dwelling place of God and the dwelling place of man, become one. Same place. All right. I know there's more questions. You'll have to save until after Thanksgiving. Love you guys. Have a good break.